Good evening.
And welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Gil Gross from KGO News Talk 810 in San Francisco. I'm also your chair for tonight's program. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our special guest tonight. James Stewart is the author of the popular 2002 book, Heart of a Soldier, which the opera is based on. He is, of course, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. David Gockley is the general director of the San Francisco Opera and considered one of the major innovators in American opera. We also have Christopher Theofanidis, a composer of Heart of the Soldier opera and really one of the world's most sought-after living composers. And we have Donna Di Novelli, the librettist of the opera Heart of a Soldier, whose wide body of work has been presented at the New York Opera and the Public Theater. Operas are often, 99% of the time, about people in far-off lands and situations so foreign to us that whether they live or die on stage only matters to us in terms of how great his or her dying aria happens to be. We are not generally an Ethiopian princess like Aida, a famed courtesan like Violetta in La Traviata, or any of the Shakespearean kings and queens and princesses of English and Norwegian royalty who found themselves singing in Italian for Verdi. However, on 9/11, many people just like us, whose lives we can easily imagine, became heroes and sadly died as heroes. It was not once upon a time. It's in our living memory just 10 years ago. And one memory is that of Rick Riscorla, who a retired U.S. soldier who led the evacuation and saved literally thousands of lives that day before losing his own. This is something rare in opera, a hero of our time who could be anyone in the audience. So how will an audience react to a piece in which we can imagine the protagonist's plight being our own? Why, of all the stories from that day, did James Stewart pick Rick's story? Why, of all the pieces he could set, did Christopher Theofanidis, famed in part for a brilliant piece based on the poetry of Rumi, written in the 13th century, did something that happened in the 21st century strike him as something he wanted to write as an opera? What was it like for Donna Di Novelli to write a libretto for a piece of nonfiction where you figure you can only change so much with the family there? And how did San Francisco Opera and David Gockley get an event that one would think would have been a coup for the Met or the New York City Opera? These are among the things that we'll talk about and more. Please join me in welcoming our terrific panelists, and let's get started. And, James, I'm going to quote Sound of Music, which is weird. Let's start at the very beginning, a very good place to start. What was it about Rick Riscorla's story that made you pick that out of all the stories from 9/11 to write about and tell the audience, you know, who he was and what he did?
Well, I'm a journalist, and I'm most fascinated by questions, by paradoxes. And I was in New York on September 11th and devastated like everyone else when David Remnick, the new editor of The New Yorker, asked me if I'd go down and do some reporting on Wall Street for that first issue. And while I was doing that, I heard that Morgan Stanley was the largest employer in the World Trade Center with over 3,000 employees and yet had some of the fewest casualties. The firms above them had devastating losses. Firms below them in the second tower had devastating losses. So I had this little question. I mean, that's a paradox to me. How did that happen? And I didn't focus on it immediately, but as the weeks went by, it kept sticking in my mind, and I kept asking about it. And eventually I learned that, yes, indeed, there was one person responsible for that, someone who had defied the Port Authority's orders to stay in the tower and ordered his people out and, in fact, marched them down the stairs. And I called Morgan Stanley to find out more about him, to try to get their help. And much to my amazement, the PR person came back to me and said, "Well, I'm sorry, we're not interested in anything having to do with September 11th. We're not going to participate in any articles about it." And I think, well, I guess this is at a dead end when, amazingly, and this is, I still think of this moment as being so significant, the PR woman said, "But his widow might be interested in talking to you, and here's her unlisted telephone number." There never would have been a book, an article, if that hadn't happened. And that turned out to be Susan. I went to meet her. I was sort of intrigued by your question, Gil, about, well, why out of all the stories to write about September 11th did I pick Rick's story? It's an amazing story. Not so much what happened on September 11th, but as I think the opera libretto brilliantly makes clear, September 11th is the culmination of an arc of a lifetime that embraces a tremendous amount of 20th century history, starting from his childhood in D-Day and World War II. Amazingly, he and his best friend Dan show up in practically every major conflict of the 20th century, and then there's a love story where he falls in love with Susan late in life. So it had some compelling dramatic examples. But as a writer, when you're confronting something as huge, as overwhelming as something like the attack on September 11th, how can you get your hands around it? I mean, I think there are two extremes. One is to just go head on, as some books did, and tell sort of vignettes, have a cast of 100, if not thousands, and try to capture all of that history, sometimes in a very finite period of time, like even minutes. Or to take the other extreme and to step back and get a very broad time, very broad perspective to look at the event, but then ruthlessly confine the story to the three main characters and what they saw. So every character in the book, the three main characters, even the smaller ones, I only told it from their point of view, what they saw. And that, to me, brings it down to a very human level. And I've always been deeply moved by literature and works that tell the story of individuals who have compelling dramas against the backdrop of major historic events, which, by the way, is something that Shakespeare was so brilliant at doing. He didn't really tell a history of those wars. He put characters in them. And here were vivid characters, to me, planted in the most significant act of contemporary history in my lifetime. And that's why I chose to tell the story the way I did.
And for people who don't know Rick's story, tell people briefly what he did.
Just very briefly, and not to give too much away of it, he didn't know his father. He was in Cornwall, England, where he was born. The GIs were there. He was very, as you can imagine, a young boy, being completely fascinated by them. They took him under their wing. They taught him how to drill. They taught him how to march. He loved them. And then one day, they vanished. They left him. I love the part in the opera where the young boy sings, you know, "Don't go, don't leave me," which establishes the theme of a soldier's life. He then, later in life, he joined the British military. He was sent to Africa in the then British colony of Rhodesia. He fought various insurrectionist wars there. He met an American paratrooper, Dan Hill, who was a special forces agent and undercover agent for the United States in Africa. They've established an incredible friendship. Dan persuaded him to become an American citizen by fighting with him in Vietnam. They were at some of the biggest, deadliest, most important battles in Vietnam. They came back. They thought their wars were behind them. They, like many veterans, had difficulty adapting to civilian life, but Rick took his training, became head of security for a bank, eventually Morgan Stanley. Dan chose another path. He, in looking for meaning in his life, he converted to Islam. And perhaps because he also was still seeking what he always thought would be the perfect just war, he ended up going to Afghanistan to fight the Russians on behalf of the Mujahideen. So he knew the Afghanistans. He knew the terrorist mentality. He wrote amazing warnings. He and Rick, after the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, were constantly trying to warn of the dangers in those towers. They were ignored. They were rebuffed. And yet Rick drilled his people fiercely in preparation for the day he knew would come when there would be another attack. And when it did, they knew what to do. He sang to them the way he'd sung to his troops, and he got them all out. He then faced the challenge. He knew there was at least one of his own people who stayed behind, that he knew there were other stragglers up there. He made the decision. He's on the phone to Dan. Dan is saying, "Rick, get out of there. It's going to collapse." Susan is on the phone, the love of his life, who he met. She's saying, "Don't leave me. Come home." He could have walked out of there a hero. And in the pivotal decision of the book and the opera, he makes the choice to go back into the tower to make sure that everyone is out, and he was never seen again.
Now, usually I would give this question to Christopher first, but David, I believe you're the one who gave the book, who gave Jim's book to, no? Read that somewhere, that you gave the book to Christopher?
Yes.
Well, there was a very important intermediary here who's not with us today, Francesca Zambello, who is a personal friend of Jim, and through their friendship got to know the book And she and I had worked on a number of new operas before, and she called me and said, you've got to get a copy of that book because I think there's an opera in there. And so I dutifully did and agreed and thought among the many composers that I knew who could address this story with the kind of sweep arch and romantic quality and the kind of diversity of musical expression that can carry an audience successfully through a 2.5 hour journey through an evening. And I had been watching the career of Chris Theofanidis, who coincidentally is from Houston, and I knew his family and therefore just watched every step that he made as he developed his career as a composer, going to Peabody, going to Yale, composing ballets for the ABT, writing one of the most successful orchestral pieces in the last 10 or 15 years that's played all the time, and it's called
Rainbow Body.
Rainbow Body, yes. I suggested Chris to Francesca. Francesca heard the music that was recorded of Chris, and Francesca knew about Donna. And so we introduced Donna and Chris together, and they formed a very, very strong relationship and agreed to work together on this project. And it was launched.
And Christopher, so this is suggested to you, and you do it. A million questions, but basically, why did you say okay to this piece? And tell me about the challenges. I mentioned before that this is somebody that we can really relate to. It could be one of us. It's a very different emotional challenge, writing for somebody whose death we can really feel. And without taking anything away from the wonderful performances I've seen of Madame Butterfly, when you know that Montserrat Caballé is, after dying, is going to come out, if she showed up in the first place, to do 19 curtain calls. But here's a story of somebody in our lifetime who, again, could be any one of us, and whose death is going to be deeply felt by an audience in a way that even the best performance of operas may not bring us.
Right. I mean, I think the thing that really drew me into it was that, you, as you say, you feel like you could know these guys. I mean, they feel like the uncle that doesn't talk a lot to you about their backstory and their back history, but they have an incredible series of stories and life stories to kind of share. And the reason why they don't talk a lot about it is because they're modest by nature. And that's the other thing that really drew me into this, was that both these guys, you know, they would, I mean, they're kind of full of bravado, but they don't brag about themselves in a serious way. And I think that in the moment when they had to choose what to do, both in Vietnam especially and then in 9/11, they chose the higher calling both times. And that was a split-second decision that just came from being that way all of their lives. Those qualities really appealed to me very deeply in reading the book, and I felt like, you know, would generate kind of music that kind of was noble and purposeful in a way. And so that was the thing that really pulled me into the opera to begin with. I mean, one of the great problems of the opera for us was, and Donna did so brilliantly, was, you know, take 60 years of history and compress it into a 2.25 hour time frame. And the first act is a very fluidly felt time from beginning to end and takes us from D-Day through early the 70s in Dallas, Texas. And that's been the hardest challenge, was to do that. Also musically, to try to find a way musically to kind of tap into the feeling of those times and those locales without letting that quality overrun the musical character or feeling of the piece. So, but it's been a great honor to work on the piece, and we've all felt, I mean, the singers, the production crew, the administration, everybody, the kind of urgency of telling this particular story.
I'm going to ask Donna this question first, but then I'd like to hear from all of you on it, because Jim mentioned Susan Rescorla, who he was introduced to and given the phone number up to start this. So here we have something else rare in opera. I mean, what other piece? Maybe The Death of Klinghoffer, where you're dealing with a real family at the time of a presentation like this. So, Donna, you have this person who you can't do scoping 60 years of history in a 2.25-hour production. It's not going to be a piece of journalism, yet you're working with nonfiction. And the family of the hero of the piece has been part of the creative process to some degree, starting with Jim's interviews. And, of course, you know they'll eventually be sitting there. So how do you, without that kind of freedom most librettists have to play with, how do you put this together?
Well, to a certain extent, there was freedom. One of the first things that Chris and I did was visit Susan Rescorla and Dan Hill. And we wanted to get to know them as people so that we could turn them into characters. Because libretto writing is not only condensing, it's often translating. And so we needed to know them. But then, in terms of speaking with Susan that first time, we also wanted their blessing on allowing them to sing, looking at those moments where song would come in. And one example is in the book, Susan calls Rick on September 11th, and she said to me, "All I did was cry." And I said, "Okay, but now I need to translate those tears. We need to make those into an aria. We need to make those into song. So together, let's talk about what those tears meant." So it was often an act of translating. Another moment is when, in the book, Rick says goodbye to his friend Dan, and we know that it's their final goodbye. He doesn't. Dan doesn't. And so that seemed to be another moment. There's many goodbyes in this piece. And certainly, Chris and I, one of the things that drove us always was that this was a piece in which time was running out for Rick. And so there was an urgency all the time, and those goodbyes became more important, and that was where the aria would come in, would slip into the actual story, which you heard Jim describe. We kept that story, but then we tried to open it up and translate moments that could be sung.
And time is such an important element of this whole opera, because not only in the 60-year history of this man, but as time is running out for Rick, as you point out, he's bringing time to literally 2,700 other human beings.
Right.
And how do you portray, because there is both this tragedy of his death and also the joy of what he brings to all of these other people and their families. And how does one convey that?
I met his personal assistant a couple of weeks ago in New York at a kind of memorial service. And she told me, she said, "The thing I remember most about Rick was that every day of my time there, he came in dancing and singing into the office. That's the way he started every single day." And because of that, people kind of rallied around that good energy that he had. And then in the moments when he was being kind of a strong will in terms of getting them to drill these things that nobody wants to drill from the 44th to the 74th floor going down the stairs, you know, once every couple of months, that's got to be a terrible thing. He had the charisma to kind of bring them to that place where they were doing that. And the idea of bringing them together through song was a really important thing. It's almost made for opera, this convention in a sense, because during Vietnam War, he gets his troops to sing together in order, and he sings to them to get them to kind of overcome their sense of fear, overcome their sense of, being separate, an individual, but a unit and a kind of a force that's kind of binding them together. And the same thing happens on September 11th. I mean, he sings these Cornish ballads that they've undoubtedly had heard probably on the drills and that kind of thing, bringing them together, a sense of kind of uniting them to go think through the board, think through the smoke, and bring them to kind of a safer place. So, that character, that quality of him dancing in the morning and doing that, exuded in such a way to the people who are around him that it brought them into that. And I think that was one of his great character qualities, really.
Gil, one of the things that I found so interesting watching Chris and Donna work is it took me over 300 pages to tell this story. And there are, let's just look at that last call between Susan and Rick on September 11th. That is, there's an amazing amount of complexity. It took really a lot of words to try to get into the reader. I mean, Susan is initially joyous that she's got him on the phone, he's alive. Then they're talking, she begins to realize, wait a minute, this sounds like some kind of goodbye, some kind of farewell. Are you leaving me? She starts to panic that he is going to never come back. At the same time, he's explaining he has this duty, that she recognizes the nobility of a higher purpose, but she's got all these conflicting feelings going on at once. It's amazingly powerful, but also extremely complex. And music can convey contradictory feelings, and Chris's music did it. I mean, I don't think any music can do it. But brilliantly, this opera is worth going to for that moment to me alone, where Melody Moore, who also just does this fantastic job of acting there, in those few words that Donna wrote and in those passages, she conveys all of those conflicting feelings through music. And that's something, you know, I love music. I love words. Words can't do that. They're too linear.
Let me ask you all about what being, writing, composing, writing the initial book, David, bringing this all into being, meant to you personally. We've talked a great deal about Rick and Susan, but this affected the whole nation. We all have feelings about it. Jim, you were there. You were in New York 9/11. I was in New York 9/11. I lived four blocks from there. Chris, you were in New York in 9/11. Donna, you were... Okay, four of the five people on the stage were in New York City that day. And, of course, David and the whole nation felt it. So how did this work into your personal feelings? Because this wasn't like covering or dealing with any other disaster. I saw reporters who I'd been in wars with cry for the first time in my life. So, Jim, let me start with you and then go down the panel from a personal perspective.
It's an incredibly emotional experience, and I think in, you know, postmodern America in the 21st century, we like to think of ourselves as rational beings, well-educated, we use our minds, and the emotions are safely, you know, walled off in places like the opera, and suddenly the emotions just took over. I mean, this was not a day you could sit back and rationally think about what happened. It was just this tidal wave that passed over of many, many, many conflicting feelings, but great sadness. And in discovering the story and writing it, I have to say it became a passion for me. It was a very emotional experience that it touched something. I mean, I realized my incredibly strong reaction to even the opera when I see it now, and, you know, I know this story extremely well, I realize there's some deep part of me that lies in this tale. And I don't know that I can put it into words exactly, but a lot of it is the fact that out of something so horrible, so tragic, so overwhelming, that something so heroic, something so noble in the human character, and in this opera, something so beautiful has arisen, touches the deepest emotional chords in my being. I mean, that to me is the essence of humanity.
And David, and was the personal feelings we all have about this day part of your decision when you said, I see an opera in this?
Yes. Being the one person on this panel who was not in New York and who does not have a direct relationship with someone who perished or someone who was a hero there, I couldn't believe what I was seeing on TV. When I went to New York and for my first trip and the towers were missing from the skyline, I just thought I got the full whammy of the tragedy. And then the characters in Jim's book, the sacrifice, this moment of decision when you become a hero, I think what Dan told Susan in this kind of three-way telephone conversation that was alluded to moments ago, and said, Susan, if Rick didn't save the last person that he possibly could save, he would come home tonight and put a bullet through his head. And how would that be? How could you live with that? So, I mean, she was damned if she did, damned if she didn't. And the personal situations ultimately are what, I thought had tremendous value, and that as we approached the 10th anniversary, which became a very important part of the way we characterized the work and scheduled the work, the idea of providing a communal catharsis for people, and I wish it could have been seen in New York. I hope it will be seen in New York, away from the shadow of the anniversary, so we can look at it maybe with the piece itself with greater objectivity. But it grabbed me, and I wanted to have the public feel that sense of caring for the characters and the loss and the heroism.
And Christopher, you were also in the city that day, mm-hmm. and whatever memories of that may have played into your feelings about the day, Rick Ruscuola, and this piece in writing this music.
Right. Well, one of the things that Don and I did in the front end of this was to talk about our specific memories of that day and what we were doing and the confusion of it. And yet, at the same time, seeing the way people reacted so well, I mean, that you were really proud to see your fellow person not losing it on the street, basically. They were really, and you also wonder what happens if everybody in Manhattan's on the street at the same time. That was the moment where everybody was on the street at the same time, walking up very calmly uptown. But the things that stood out early in those days that became really part of the opera, and there are small details, but there were real details. One of them was, of course, that day was the most spectacularly beautiful day. And everybody says this, but it was so true. I mean, I walked across Central Park from my apartment to teach at Juilliard that morning, and I remember thinking, my God, I mean, this is like, I've never seen this kind of blue
before.
It's
a sharp blue sky.
It was the sharpest blue, and that was a strange detail. And then the other thing was, a couple of days after the towers fell, I felt very compelled to go down to Lower Manhattan and just be as close as I could, as close as they were letting people in. And I made it down pretty far, but the thing that I saw everywhere was just paper. There was paper. I mean, the streets were just lined with this singed paper. There was no office furniture, nothing in the way of pieces of building or something like that. It was just paper was strewn everywhere. And these two things became part of our operatic conception of very specific details that had a personal resonance to us, made it into the opera as well. Kind of in a way, it forced us to remember that from a very personal perspective.
The strange thing about that sharp blue sky that for some reason my wife remembered and I had completely forgotten was the night before we had a fairly vicious thunder and lightning storm with cracks of lightning the likes of which you rarely see even on the East Coast. And there was no foreboding for it because the next day was beautiful. But still, Donna, how did your feelings and memories work into this piece?
Well, to a certain extent, both Chris and I had to concentrate on character as opposed to thinking that we could write something about 9/11 mm-hmm. because of the immensity. But I know on that day I was in Brooklyn and I had a phone call about what was happening, but my television and my radio reception was gone. So I didn't really know what was happening, but I had one major desire, which was to get home. And home for me at the time was Hartford. So I was driving down Long Island and getting on a ferry, and it was just all about being with the people I loved that day. And one of the things I learned in studying the character of Rick and what makes a soldier is that, a soldier is trained to go toward danger. So here I was running home as fast as I could and then understanding that not only was he a soldier who went towards danger to help people, but that the reason that he was able to save all those lives was because he also defied authority. The Port Authority was saying, everyone remain at your desk. This tower is secure. And Rick said, piss off. I'm getting my people out. And so, it was by concentrating on that character and in a way not the immensity of the loss that day that I could write it.
There's an interesting part of this. We're talking about history in Vietnam and all of this. And there's another
part that I don't know that's been talked about, but which I'm happy to see. For a long time, and I guess because our experience in Vietnam was so unhappy, any soldier who was in Vietnam was portrayed in the media as less than heroic. My news media, if somebody were to go off and shoot his family or something, if he had been to Vietnam, it was a Vietnam veteran, blah, blah, blah. And this would happen again and again and again, even if the person had just worked in the infirmary there or was a cook and had never picked up a weapon in their lives. And yet, that background and the heart of who Rick Scorla is an important part of this piece and a positive part of this piece.
Yeah, well, I was firmly planted in the anti-war generation and probably shared some of those prejudices. I did not fight in the military or go to Vietnam. And getting to learning about Dan and Rick utterly transformed my views of what soldiers are like, or certainly what at least some soldiers are like. They were incredibly thoughtful, extremely well-read. They spent their hours at night debating deep themes of life and death and philosophy in a way that I can guarantee most of the anti-war protesters were never doing. They cared deeply about their men, and the opera, I think, captures this so well that Rick, to me, one of the most moving scenes in both the book and the opera is Rick is so haunted by the death of the men that he was assigned to protect. He saw war as protecting his fellow soldiers, not killing the enemy. That was maybe necessary, but to him, the essence of war was protecting his men. And when his medic dies, it has a profound impact. The medic dies in his arms in Vietnam. It has a profound effect on him. I actually read the letter that he wrote to the medic's sister afterwards describing that event. It's beautifully depicted in the opera. Dan, you could argue, did he have an even more tender heart? His approach was he didn't even want to know the names of his men because if they were killed, it was too painful for him to know anything about their family. He wanted to have that detachment. They both cared so deeply about the soldiers they fought with and about their fellow men, which, again, is a paradox. I don't think we thought of soldiers. We thought they were out there killing their fellow men, not trying to protect them. And yet you see the essence of that philosophy emerges on September 11th in Rick.
I was going to say that one of the themes that kind of touches on that a little bit, there's a scene in the opera that we tried to have the soldiers after their service in Vietnam kind of sitting around talking and reminiscing, but also acknowledging what do we do now? I mean, we have these soldiers' hearts, and they're trained, to respond in a moment's notice for something. And here we are, building pancake houses. We're doing very, ordinary types of jobs. What is this? Is this what we're supposed to be doing? And I think actually being ready at a moment's call is also the other thing that is the great value of a soldier and somebody who's trained in that way is that they're all, as Donna was saying, to go towards the danger, but to look it straight in the eye. This is the kind of one of the themes of the opera too that we tried to focus towards September 11th was that there is great need. There's great need in a society for that kind of heart and that kind of way of dealing with things. Ultimately, it's the most deep expression of humanism in a way that you're not ironic in the very end. You're doing it absolutely looking it straight in the eye, and I think that's one of the great themes of their lives really that came out.
One more question for me, and then let's get to the questions from the audience. Tell me about the working process. Christopher, Donna, between the two of you, this is the thing that even in pop music, lyricists and composers always get asked, which comes first? How do you work together to decide the shape of the story, what's an aria, what little moment may be so important that it really needs more time? Tell me about that process.
Why don't you take that one?
Okay, well, there's two processes. One is that we spent, I think, 4 years writing the scenario, and that was with David, with Jim, with Francesca, with Patrick. So for 4 years, we went back and forth until we realized what was the shape. And then it was about collaborating together. And once we started working together, it was almost I can't even separate it, that the music started to lead. So that if in the first scene the young boy says to the soldiers who are leaving for Normandy, I want you to stay, and I write it once, and then Chris in the music writes that line, I want you to stay four times, we've got a theme, and then that's going to come back, and it's going to come back. And so it just became so fluid, and I would go down to New Haven, and Chris would play different parts, and then I would go back and write, and I would send him more. But it was a very fluid process and a joy.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and tonight we're hosting Heart of a Soldier, Honoring Strength Through Song with James Stewart and the San Francisco Opera. I'm Gil Gross from KGO Radio, and I'm joined by James Stewart, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of Heart of a Soldier, David Gockley, the general director of the San Francisco Opera, Christopher Theofanidis, the composer of the San Francisco Opera's new production, Heart of a Soldier, and Donna DiNovelli, the librettist of Heart of a Soldier. And it is time to take questions from the audience. Should have saved this one for last because it ties everything up so well, and yet I'm going to do it first so we make sure we get it in. What do you think the message of this opera is? Any of you, and all of you.
I'll start, so nobody's saying anything yet. the big question, I mean, the Jim's idea of talking about questions is kind of the leading into things. And I think that for me personally, that question was, how do you remember the fallen? It became the obsession of trying to understand not even the purpose, but the meaning, or was there any meaning in what happened? I mean, what comes out of it? Partly it's the idea of looking for something that has a glimmer of something good in these tragic situations. And the thing that we made a theme in the opera was this idea of remembrance. Constantly you're dealing with people dying at various stages in here and in the opera, and the way that people carry forward the memory of the other person is to absorb actually the best parts of their character into what they are as people and take it forward. So that, in other words, you're not just remembering somebody with your mind or your memory, but you're actually physically remembering them by taking on their best qualities and carrying them forward. And this theme kind of gets explored in three different kind of louder and louder resonances in the opera, so that at the end we see Dan and Susan really transformed by the way Rick was as a person, and you see them as kind of almost stronger and better and newer people as a result of carrying his strength forward. So that was one of the big reasons for being, from my point of view.
Well, and I think it's really important that both Chris and Jim have talked about questions, because we raise questions in the opera, and it's really up to the audience to answer. The first thing I learned as a dramatist was, if you want to send a message, call Western Union. it's not our job to give you a message. It's our job to question and to illuminate, and then it's up to the audience to come up with the answers.
Yeah, nothing pleases me more than when readers tell me what they feel the message of the book was, and it's completely different from one person to another. And I think there are probably many themes that are there and that could be coaxed out of it. One, certainly to me, is that there are higher purposes in life than our own selves, that we never know when an unthinkable event is going to happen that thrusts us into the situation where we have to choose perhaps our own self-interest over giving ourselves to our fellow man. How would we respond? And that's something that I think this story makes people ponder. And there's a theme of loss and departure that goes throughout this. It's something that the people in the military face every day. They never know when they're going to die. But the reality is that we're all going to leave at some point. We're all going to leave someone behind. That is the human condition. And I believe people take on a kind of immortality when they do something that touches others' lives that will survive them and will make the world a better place for the foreseeable future.
This is essentially a follow-up from the audience, just by ordering the question this way. Do you hope the opera will transcend 9/11, this person asks? Will the themes be seen as universal? It's
an interesting question. 9/11 is so powerful in itself. Do you think these themes will come through, or because we're still in the living memory, in the close living memory of this event for so many people, that it may overpower the message and the themes that Jim just talked about?
I think we commissioned and produced this work not to be a 9/11 piece, but to have enduring values and enduring ideas and elicit enduring feelings about the characters and about a situation in which, or situations which defined the characters, and 10, 15, 20 years from now, if anything, the characteristics and the characters will resonate more than they do now, because they'll be separated from the immediacy of this anniversary. I was involved in the original Nixon in China, which was very much about Nixon and Kissinger and their families going to China in 1972 or 4 or whatever it was, to meet with Mao and Chou Enlai. And we were certainly much closer to it in 1987 when the opera was done. But now hardly anybody remembers, you know, what happened at that date. And they remember the characters that John Adams, the composer, and Alice Goodman, the librettist, depicted in that opera. And it's the characters in the opera that will be immortalized by the music, not the characters in history.
But let me ask you a question, Jim. I mean, you're in an interesting thing. Shakespeare certainly did not need Verdi. But on the other hand, a successful opera gives you the possibility of being connected to a work that has, even though you've got the 20th anniversary of another of your books about to come out, a 20th anniversary edition, still the lifespan of successful opera can outlive us all.
Oh, yeah, that thought has crossed my mind. I mean, I have to say, I never in a million years thought that when I was writing this book that it would become an opera. Never crossed my mind. And realistically, why would it? I mean, how many books get turned into operas? How many nonfiction books get turned into operas? How many nonfiction books about contemporaneous events get turned into operas? Very, very few. If I had been planning an opera on this, I was destined for disappointment. But I was thrilled because I love music, I love opera, and it has occurred to me that it does two things. It perpetuates the story into a new medium in a way that I think I hope will last a very, very long time. And it helps do what the previous question was asking about, which is to get audiences to focus on the themes that transcend the immediate events of history that we're talking about. And I do think the passage of time is helping, but the opera itself and the opera genre, by in some ways simplifying and heightening the emotional content of the story, helps people focus on those timeless themes. I remember when the book came out, I got angry letters from people saying, I thought this book was about 9/11, and how come you started it with, you know, him meeting Susan in New Jersey, and what's all this stuff about Africa in here? And I realized, you know, with those readers, I was failing. I mean, the themes were not emerging, and I do believe they're there, and I trust intelligent readers to figure that out, but I think the opera is going to, it takes it to a new level, and it's going to help make sure that happens for a very long period of time. And so I am thrilled about that.
I like the term that the music or the operatic rendition mythologizes the story and gives it a kind of core and a kind of enduring quality that will give it a chance to remain.
I've got many questions about the critics and the mixed reviews that generally come with almost any contemporary work. By the way, if you want some fun reading someday, there's a great book, I don't think it's ever been out of print, by Nick Slonimsky called Lexicon of Musical Invective, where you can read the mixed reviews of Brahms' symphonies, Beethoven's Ninth, and many, many other things. But one person interesting, wants to know if the New York Times reviewer might have been more positive if the critic was a military veteran. And then another person just asked, what do the critics miss that an audience might see? Because it's had a very powerful effect on the audience.
I'll take a stab at that. I mean, you know, you can never predict what's going to happen. You know, we're partially artistically living in a time which doesn't, the idea of irony being kind of the most witty thing that you can do in art and kind of an important thing to do in art is a time that makes it difficult for things which deal with emotional subjects, which deal with things that are not about the experiment of them, but they're really about kind of humanistic kind of ideals. And so, there are a lot of people, I think, who look at the arts with that lens. And it happened to be that this young guy in his mid-20s in the Times was very looking at, I think, through that lens. And that's fine. You know, there are going to be people who like that. But I think that in the end, you know, that we had such a strong – what we set out to do, I think, we did. In the sense that we had the other night, and I see General Myatt here, it's wonderful to see you, we had so many veterans in the audience, and so many of them came up to us afterwards. You know, there was a wonderful Korean War veteran who came up, and he's never seen an opera in his life. He goes, you know, I haven't cried like that and let go of some of these things that I've been holding on for all of these years, ever, until I saw this. And he goes, I cried 6 times in one evening. You know, I mean, you know, things, very personal stories like that that show a kind of meaning that this story has for people. And, you know, for whatever the quibbles you might have here and there, that's actually what we're trying to do in a way. I mean, music has the ability to touch a direct nerve in that emotional being that we are, all are. And, you know, it's bound to happen that people will find things. That's their job if they're critics, I suppose, is to find things that don't work. You know, on the whole, I have to say, I think we feel very proud of it and feel like the people who are involved in it are committed, which is the other thing. The artists, the singers are over the moon committed to this project in a way that is amazing.
We didn't write this piece for the critics. You know, I challenged Chris all the way along. Let's tell the story. And this is not a story, of great complications and stuff that that intellectual sophisticates would find really important and stimulating. This is a story that's heartfelt, that calls for, as I said earlier, soaring melody. I challenged Chris again and again, give us big, tunes, give us big, long lines and stuff that is going to pull on the hearts of the regular audience member out there, the way the Turandot pulls the heart. And I realize it might be somewhat retro. It might be something that finally we go back to as opera that we deserted for 75 years of the 20th century when, serialism and intellectualism was driving all the so-called art music that was being received well. And what happened was, of course, the audience just kind of drifted away. But we have a big theater. We want to please. That's the kind of big, burly piece that we wanted from Chris and Donna. I kind of figured that we would get slammed somewhat, but I didn't care. I think we wanted to go as our hearts led us to go, whether we're hearts of soldiers or hearts of opera producers or authors.
Go ahead, sir.
Well, I think criticism at its best is a discussion. I know even if I'm going to a movie, I save things for after I've seen it, and then I think about the ideas. And so that's my only hope, is that people will see the piece and then read every review and think about it in terms of, you know, what is it that they experienced versus what's also being discussed. And I think that's how it should work.
Yeah, I'm actually glad they asked that question because maybe I can be, I'm the most objective up here because I'm not objective, but I didn't write the music. I can't take any credit or any blame for it. I didn't write the libretto. And so I'll be a critic and say that I was in the audience on at the premiere, and I don't know that I've ever experienced anything like that in a theater.
Why don't you talk your New York Times employer into writing your piece about it?
That's a touchy issue. I hasten to say that I have, of course, no influence whatsoever. They slammed. The Daily Times gave a fabulous review of my latest book, Tangled Webs, and then the Sunday Times slammed it just as bad as they did this. And I worked there. I mean, that's the way it works. I admire the separation of church and state there, but I certainly don't always agree. I was very struck, by the way, in the Times, we're going to something that David said, which I think was a very good point, that the reviewer, I believe, said, well, the most successful operas about heroes and positive characters have been written by Olivier Messiaen and who was the other one, John?
Philip Glass.
Okay. Now, I happen to enjoy both those composers. I like a lot of very avant-garde contemporary music, but I have to say it's an acquired taste. And do you see many operas by Olivier Messiaen being programmed anywhere? And I think that's the taste of the critic, and there's a place for that. But to bring that judgment to something that is not is trying to be something, exactly what David said. And I just want to say that I feel that I've never been more euphoric than I was that opening night because I felt everything that everyone, including me, had ever hoped for in translating this from book to stage had been achieved, and frankly, then some.
Amen.
Two things on that. It's interesting. When Samuel Barber wrote an opera for the opening of the new Met, it was slammed by the critics, and now that he's dead, they're reconsidering. You know, that's really a beautiful piece. It's interesting that it happens, and then I keep thinking, although I'm sure he wasn't the first person to say it, but my friend, late composer David Diamond, was the first person I ever heard say that critics are the people who come to the battlefield after the fight is over and shoot the wounded. So. That's okay. And it was after I had commissioned David to write some songs for my wife. So here's a question from the audience, and it touches on this in a way. To David Gockley, how do you balance the need for new opera, this person writes cutting-edge opera, with the audience's desires for tradition? And how do you do that? Because even though the opera in Verdi and Puccini's day and Beethoven's day, people were coming to see new works, one of the attacks on opera has become somewhat ossified, and the audience is coming to see nothing that was written now, which is really a change from operatic history. So how do you deal with the audience's expectations?
Well, we have a season of 9 operas, and 7 of them you could call traditional. Nixon in China, which we're doing this summer, and Heart of a Soldier are the exceptions, and so, you know, I have to play very much towards the overall taste of the public to see a traditional repertory that includes both really the great favorites, like, for example, Carmen or Magic Flute, some pieces at the edge of the traditional repertory like Lucrezia Borgia, etc. But I keep looking back to where we got these great works, and if there hadn't have been people who were willing to take the chance on Verdi or, you know, subsidizing Mozart at the Austrian court or impresarios promoting Puccini in Italy of the early 20th century, we wouldn't have the great pieces that we have, we wouldn't have the repertory. So I think that a portion of our effort has got to be extending the repertory. And it's been, as I said moments ago, during the 20th century, it was a slog because composers were simply not writing for what the audience wanted. In fact, you know, as Milton Babbitt's famous line was about his music, "Who cares if you listen?" And there was that kind of attitude in academia and, you know, throughout the critical community, and conductors were co-opted into this, you know, situation. And, you know, thank heavens we got past the mid part of the century, and gradually people like Chris, you know, Philip Glass was mentioned a moment ago. He had the chutzpah to say, "I'm going my own way." He was a Milton Babbitt student at one time, and decided to go his own way and write his own style. And he then gave way to John Adams and a whole range of things. And the Broadway composers inspired people to write, you know, much more popular stuff. And we have an eclectic world now of composers that are much more likely to succeed in the opera house than 50 years ago. So I rejoice in the possibility of being able to follow in the footsteps of people who gave us our repertoire to give repertoire on to the future.
And the irony, of course, is Milton loved nothing to listen to more than a good show tune. Go figure. And knew more about show tunes than almost anybody on the planet. Which brings us to this question from the audience. Have directors of other opera companies come to see this production for consideration for their own companies? And besides answering that, tell me a little bit more, along the lines of what you're saying, Christopher, about one of the big problems in contemporary music always in its history has not even been so much the first performance, but the second performance. It's especially true in opera, where the costs of mounting something can be so dear and need so much support. So let's talk about that.
Right. Well, I think, fortunately, the attitude has changed quite a bit in recent years. I mean, before, when a new piece was commissioned, this is across genres, it was a kind of something that the organization would do partly for the prestige of doing it. It wasn't really in the metabolism of the institution to do a lot of contemporary music. This was something that they put out there as a kind of commission project. And so I think what's changed is that over many years that a lot of institutions actually, you know, through the change of administration, through the change of direct leadership in the artistic realm, actually like new music, like what's being written today. And so there are opportunities now for second, third performances, multiple performances, which is a great thing. It's very encouraging to get that second phone call and realize that this is great. We don't take it off the shelf and it doesn't have to sit there forever. With opera, of course, it's a very difficult thing because of the financial constraints of it. It's such an incredibly expensive thing to do. And yet there's nothing more grand. I mean, when opera works right, I mean, it's the thing that people want to rally around. It's storytelling in its best and kind of grandest form in some ways. And, you know, one hopes. There are a number of directors who are here and have been here in the last couple of days, but are also coming in the next couple of performances that are interested in it. And we'll see, keep our fingers crossed and see what happens.
I will say, sadly, negative reviews do affect other companies jumping into the breach of doing a contemporary work. And, you know, I hope that we can get over that and people can be bigger and convince their own boards of directors and their own staffs and all of that to take this on, because there's nothing like a second and third chance to give Chris and Donna another motivation to say, well, that should be expanded, that should be contracted, that should be made better. I mean, I'm always one that feels that a work is never finished as long as you're alive and can make it better. So, you know, we have two people in the production team, Patrick Summers, who's artistic director in Houston, Francesca Zambello, the director who's artistic advisor in Washington at the Kennedy Center. And so there is an automatic opening for this work to go there, I would think. Now, the New York City Opera would have been a great place for this to go, but we all know what's happening with the New York City Opera. I mean, maybe they'll be interested, but they have to be alive first.
But one of the things that movies have changed, because of the power of the Internet and people sharing things, word of mouth in the audience is now much more important than anything a movie critic says. Movie critics just bemoan this fact over and over, but they've basically lost their power to make or break a film. Is there some way through a webcast or something to bring that where people across the country can see a production and that word of mouth then, as with movies, overpowers?
Yes. As many of you know, we have the capability to capture something on video, high-definition video, and we're going to record three performances later in the run and show it to Chris and show it to, you know, Donna and everybody, and see if we have the makings of not only an audio CD or download, whatever you call it these days, but a video, and try to use the material as imaginatively as we can to promote the efficacy of the work.
Unfortunately, we reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question, so we'll make it brief. And this was an interesting question, probably to tie it up with, from the audience. Given the emotional toll of writing this opera, would you do it again? Donna, let's start with you.
Well, I've been bugging him constantly to do another one. So I don't know. I mean, I have ideas, and, you know, I'm ready. Yeah, I'm actually starting one tomorrow with someone else, but I would really want to work with Chris.
It's a physically exhausting process. I mean, emotionally, and it takes a long time. Ironically, the next opera I'm doing is on the Buddha. So I think, you know, it's possible that I'll find some redemption through going through Siddhartha and end up on the other side by wanting to do many more. I don't know. We'll see.
And a sense of peace. And David, you have no choice but to do it again and again.
Absolutely.
And I'm kind of in the unique piece that this is probably my one and only. And I'm thrilled to have gotten that.
So somebody suggested the 4 one-act operas.
Well, that's I don't ever want to say never. And any of you have any thoughts? I mean, I'd love to work with you all again. Absolutely.
Amy Tan would agree with you. And she was librettist in addition to being the original author of Bonesetter's Daughter.
Well, there you go. You never know who is going to be involved. Actually, a fine librettist that you've probably run into is Jack Larson, who's a brilliant poet, and most of you know him as Jimmy Olsen on the original TV series Superman. So there's a lot of interesting people out there doing wonderful work, including our 4 panelists. Our thanks to James Stewart, David Gockley, Christopher Theofanidis, and Donna Di Novelli. Also thank our audiences here on radio and the Internet. I'm Gil Gross, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.